as always, it's very annoying with radio, is all the best conversations happen off air every single week. I'm sorry about this. Look, Krush has to shoot off, but he, as always, comes out with all these interesting things. And just tell us what you were talking about there. That was about the 150 people. It was fascinating.
Yeah, it was a book by Robin Dunbar called How Many Friends Does One Person Need? Robin Dunbar is an evolutionary biologist, and his book actually goes into a lot of detail about a lot of things. One of the interesting things is he actually, based on research, he's explaining that 6% of the population can trace their ancestry back to Genghis Khan.
And what did Zena say?
I said my son definitely is.
But his main thing, the Dunbar number, which is actually named after him, is 150, which is the amount of friends one person can handle. Now, he explains that the friends that he talks about in this circle, the 150, are the kind of people who, if you're flying to Hong Kong and you saw them in the airport, they would be offended if you didn't get up and say hello. And that's kind of how he describes a person in your sort of circle of friends. And he explains how you've got the inner circle, and then there's the, you know, onion layers, the layers of circles, which ones sort of get, as people get further or further away. And people can move within circles, so...
I ignore a lot of my friends, though. I hide from them. Actually, I had a conversation with somebody when I was probably about in my... I don't know, late 20s, early 30s, and there was a girl there, and she was probably early 20s, and she kept saying, oh, we're all going out for a drink tonight, and I used to sort of go, I don't really want to go. And he said, why don't you ever come out? Surely you want to make new friends? I said, no, I've got enough friends. And she couldn't get over this. She was really shocked at the idea that you didn't want more friends. And at that time, I mean, I must admit, I'm a bit more open now, but at that time, I thought, look, I've got enough friends. I don't want to know anybody else, really. I will professionally, but outside of my own circle, I found it very difficult to actually have a meaningful relationship with people, because you only get so many hours in the day, and you really do get to the stage where to adopt another friend you have to drop one, because you literally have to say, you're a really nice person, I'd really like to be friends with you, but if I actually spend half a day with you, that means I'm not spending it with someone I've known for 10 years, you know. Mm-hmm. and you do get overload, don't you? And I know people have got thousands of people on their Facebook sites, and you do wonder whether, is there any meaning to that? Really, it becomes meaningless after a while, doesn't it?
Well, that's what led us to the discussion, because we were all just liking each other on Facebook.
But we're all friends here. We're all friends. And, okay, we're going to continue now.
You're going to read something, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, I was looking for something to read out that doesn't have too many swear words.
you can always use F.
Oh, yeah. No, yes. I might read something out. I'm in the process of writing something, so it's not completed and it hasn't been gone over. So if there are mistakes, I apologise, but it's just meeting with... This is actually... the book's called Die, Dollar, Die. It's about a character called Philip Banks, who's an analyst with a kind of very select, old-fashioned English bank that deals with the assets of the rich and deals with them no questions asked. And he's a young guy in his 20s, ambitious, trying to make it in the world. And he works for the company Delange Martin. And he eventually gets an interview with Mr. Delange. So that's quite a big thing for him. He's only ever seen his picture on a website or something. Even though he works for the company, he's never met the guy. He knows what he looks like, but he's never spoken to him. And that's the experience, I think, when you're young in a big company, you want to climb the greasy pole, you want to get ahead, you need money, etc. And that's the sort of person he is at this stage in the story. So I'll just read a bit out. So it says, heart pumping, Banks entered the lift alone and pressed 8. A voice confirmed his presence and destination. Welcome to Delange Martin. Please state your name and position. Banks looked about the lift for a sign of a speaker. Philip Banks, asset management analyst. His heartbeat quickened. Please enter your code. Banks tapped Peter Bingo 82 onto the screen, and with a discreet ping, the lift began to rise. He'd checked the soles of his shoes. Floor 8 was infamous for its ash-white wooden floors. Anyone making it mark would be fired. So went the legend. The lift stopped and the doors opened. Banks was met with an extended hand and the ambiguous smile of Bridget Ainsworth. Short blonde hair with good teeth. She smelt like the perfume counter in a department store. Despite her pulchritude, she was more Rottweiler than receptionist. Banks only knew her from the company website and anecdotes. He'd never met her before. There was no waiting couch or reception desk, just a white, empty, open space that led to several white wooden doorways. He's here, Bridget spoke into the headset. She led him across the open floor towards the door, furthest from the lift. You may go in now, she said, flashing her flawless pearl teeth at him. He took a single breath, then twisted the door handle. Philip, come in. Delange held a hand, indicating he was on a call. Unlike Mr. Martin, who was invisible, Delange was the public face of the company. Despite this, Banks had never seen him in the flesh before. So it was with excitement and great curiosity that he ticked off all the familiar traits that Mr. Delange was so characteristic, straight hair, cut short, glowing like pale gold, teeth glazed like white bone china, and skin tanned and wrinkled. His eyebrows were too perfect, plucked, and he appeared to be wearing makeup, Vane thought Banks, perhaps even insecure. Take a seat. Banks approached the desk and sat. The sheer size of the office took Banks by surprise. To his left, a glazed door revealed a meeting room with views over St. Paul's. Framed photos and oddly familiar paintings adorned the wall, whilst to his right were two solid-looking doors of teak. I'll be there on Tuesday. Goodbye. Delange looked up and made eye contact. I've been hearing a lot of good things about you, Philip. His warmth was disarming. His finger began galloping on the table to the rhythm of his speech. De Rosa is a happy client. Banks held his tongue. I want you to go to Shanghai. Meet Jameson. Mr. Delange stopped tapping his fingers. Well, what do you think? Sounds exciting. He tried to rein in the adrenaline that shot through his veins. May I ask what I'll be doing? Banks grew uncomfortable as he was treated to a silent but authoritative stare that was for longer than was comfortable. Where am I? Longer than was... Sorry, I have to flick through the computer here and I've lost my place, damn it. What do you think? Okay, I'll say it again. Sounds exciting. He reined in the adrenaline that shot through his veins. May I ask what I'll be doing? Banks grew uncomfortable as he was treated to a silent but authoritative stare for longer than was acceptable. Delange broke tension with an apostrophizing rap to his desk. The firm is over 170 years old, and the one aspect of our client's favor for us is our maxim. No questions asked. The stare reconnected. You wouldn't want to break with tradition now, would you? No, sir. Banks cleared his throat quietly. Delange stood and walked towards the window overlooking the Thames. If all you do is ask questions, all you will get are answers. Philip. And answers do not rule the world. Do not control the governments, the corporations. They buy very little. When clients want answers, they go to Wikipedia. But when they wish to sell, they come to us. No questions asked. Do you understand? Yes, I do, sir. Right, you'll be helping Jameson with a client of ours, Geoffrey Choi. He's an inner party member of the Communist Party cabinet. Owns property in Shanghai. I understand you worked on leasing with Shanghai Tower in Liverpool. Yes, a little, sir. I was shown the details, but never actually got to work on it. Banks remembered being asked to read a prospectus as thick as a novel on the proposed tower for Liverpool's Dockland area. Can I trust you? Delange's fingers began tapping again. Of course. Banks tried to moderate his breathing, to hide his palpitating heart. What do you want to do with your life, Philip? Succeed. See how far I can go. Banks knew the corporate code. Never state money as your objective, though if it wasn't everything, you'd be out of a job. Don't you want to change the world? Delange twisted in his chair, offering another face. Do you believe in God, Philip? No. What would you say if I said I do? Delange moved back slowly into his chair. That I have met him, spoken with him. Brown leather squelched noisily. I'd say everybody is entitled to their beliefs. Delange laughed out unselfconsciously, then stopped abruptly and leaned forward across the table. Did you know that I know your father? Impossible, thought Banks. Notwithstanding the grammatical error, his father had been an architect with a small practice in Birmingham. He would have known nothing about property dealings Delange Martin undertook. You must be mistaken. My father died years ago. Perhaps, replied Delange, whose stare never wavered. Banks felt irked at the discrepancy. His fingernails dug into the cloth of his trousers. Do you know who you are? Of course, replied Banks quietly. What an odd question. Philip, nothing is by chance, Delange ossified in his chair. Everything is arranged, his eyes squeezed in on Banks. Remember that. In a flash of tactlessness, Banks rolled his eyes, emoting incredulity. It was overlooked. With his message spawned, Delange nodded his head solemnly and let the tense crow's feet ease from his face. Banks felt as though he had just signed up for something he had no knowledge of. Jameson is expecting you on Monday. I just lost my place. Damn it. Okay, I'm going to leave it there because I've lost my place in there. And it goes on. It's a shame, but there you go.
There were some great examples of showing not telling in there. That was very interesting.
Absolutely.
My favourite bit was the shoes.
The shoes?
The shoes. How he's checking his shoes because he knows upstairs they've got a really nice clean
floor. Oh, I see, yes.
And he doesn't say he's nervous, but you show us that he's nervous by telling us about the shoes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's inferred, yes.
I had a comment to make there.
Yeah.
Why would he have been surprised at the size of the office?
I think because it's very big.
Yeah, but he would have expected that.
No, not as big as this.
Okay. So it's massive.
It's big.
Okay. And I liked the character portrait of the receptionist. We all know receptionists like that.
The word Rottweiler
summed it up straight away.
Ding.
It's great.
Yeah. So, I agree with you, like show and tell. Particularly, it's interesting when you ask people if they're writing a book, they say, well, it's about this. And they give you all these descriptions of what it's about. And then when you ask them again and you try and expand on that, they haven't actually worked out how they're going to say that. Because a book is a story is actually, it's very easy to say, I'm going to write about marriage and how this is dysfunctional, or I'm going to write about how power is this. And it's very easy to summarize things. The difficult thing is dramatizing, and a book should be a dramatization. So, the idea is to first of all, you start off with what you want to say, but then you have to actually say, how can you put that message across without actually stating it?
That's right. It's in the detail as well, like how you use Sir, which tells us a lot more about De Long than Philip and helps us understand him as an authoritative figure.
Yeah, when he's under stress, yes, Sir.
Yeah.
He's kind of it's like saying, I'm going to put myself back in my own place now because I've broken one of the codes of the company by asking a question.
Yes. And one thing I'd like to say is how the code is no questions asked. And then what happens? He asks questions of Philip.
Yes.
He's allowed to.
He's allowed to.
Not only that, he gives an answer.
Yes.
Because he said no questions asked, that's the code. But then he does answer the question.
Well, if you're in power, you're allowed to do whatever you like.
Yeah, sure.
That's the whole point.
Something like
that. Although it's more of a threat than an answer, isn't it?
No, well, he says you're going to be working with so-and-so doing this and this and this. Yeah. So that's the answer, you know.
Yeah.
So.
That's true.
He doesn't expand and tell him what he's going to be doing. But, it's coming. It's interesting when you're writing a book, I'm on the first draft now, so I'm on about 45,000 words. I'm targeting for about 100,000. So I'm trying not to go back and edit. I have edited a bit of that, but other parts that I've got I haven't edited. And you never know what a story is going to be until you've finished it, really. Because what happens is you have it in mind, I'm going to write about this, it's going to be like this. And then you start writing it. What happens is it shoots off in another unimagined direction. And you get inspiration and you add new characters and you do things like this. And there is this balance of how much do you allow yourself to veer off what you thought the story was and how much do you rein it in and how much do you let it go?
Sounds like you're a bit of a pantser, as we say, in the writing industry rather than a planner.
A pantser, what's that?
You fly by the seat of your pants when you write. You just start at the beginning and you see where you go.
Well, to a certain extent, usually what I do is I'll give a title of the chapter I'm doing and I'll have an overview of what's going to happen. So like the scene I'm writing at the moment is he meets up with Choi, is this Jeffrey Choi, the Chinese guy. There's been a whole series of events happened before then, but I'm writing now and Choi has an objective of giving him this particular job, which will compromise him to make him a bit of a spy or that sort of thing. So I know what he wants to do, but I don't know how we're going to do that. And that's the dramatization, if you like. I know what it's about. I know what will happen. I know the end result, but I don't know how we will get there.
Have you got some landmarks along the way that you intend to explore?
Yeah. No, I know. I've got a series of concepts on that of about three books, and they all sort of roll on, like Die, Dollar, Die, The Shadows, and 1 Billion, The Final Solution. So it's kind of all... Yeah, I've all got it in there. And I don't know. I just take the view that... the publishers probably want more than one book, and also I have quite a lot of subjects I want to cover. So I thought I'll make them short, you know, 250 pages, something like that. And fast to read, airport novel type thing is where I'm going for. Anyway.
One thing I did want to say is that approach, having a destination and a good beginning, but little highlights in the middle, that was told to me, that's the best way to write a book.
Hmm. Well, I mean, there's so many different ways, aren't there? I mean, you could you could do it. Okay, well, I'd like to say thank you for everybody for coming in. It's been real fun to have a studio with lots of people, and we've done some interesting things.
And such dynamic, interesting guests, too.
Yes, absolutely. So let's say goodbye to everybody. Zina, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And Rodney, who I met on Monday. It's nice to see you again.
Yeah, thank you.
And Tonya?
Hello. Thanks.
And Midge Mark.
Yes.
So thank you for coming in.